From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. When Netflix got the pitch for the limited series Beef, the streamer blew the competition away.
Netflix had made such an incredible offer to us that it felt like the right place. They were just kind of gung-ho from the very beginning, and they just like put it on the table and was like, we want to do this, and it felt safe in that way. And the process with them has been really wonderful.
Beef star Steven Yeun talks about the joys of filming the limited series that would go on to sweep the awards season, earning him 2 Emmys. He also shares why he and Beef co-star Ali Wong broke out in hives after production wrapped. But first, two buddies banter while I'm away. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW.
I'm Matt Bellany, filling in for Kim Masters. Today, we've got Lucas Shaw, media and entertainment head at Bloomberg with us. Hi, Lucas.
Hey, Matt.
All right, so let's get into Disney. You had a report last week that updated what I think people have been talking about around town. It's sort of known, but not known, that the Disney succession race has really come to a head. This is the succession race to replace Bob Iger, the current CEO, who has said that he is going to leave at the end of 2026. Now, we know he has said that many, many times in the past, and he has never left except for the one time when he did leave, and then he came back a year later. But this time he says he's really focused on succession. The board is focused, and they are going to pick someone, and they have whittled it down to 4 internal candidates. Doesn't mean they still won't pick someone from the outside, but they are really focusing on 4 internal candidates. They are the head of the film group, Alan Bergman, the head of the parks division, Josh D'Amaro, the head of ESPN sports unit, Jimmy Pitaro, and the head of the television unit, Dana Walden. I hate to even handicap at this point, but what do you think the sense is right now among the chattering classes around town of the hierarchy here?
The sense has been that Dana Walden and Josh D'Amaro are the 2 front runners, and that Alan Bergman and Jimmy Pitaro are sort of the next tier. Now, people high up at Disney push back on this. They note that the board has all 4 of them on the list, that Bob Iger is spending time with all of them, and that they'll all get a shot at it. But I think because D'Amaro runs Parks, which is Disney's best performing business right now, and Dana has the sort of creative chops and the relationship with the community in Hollywood that I think is seen as another key part of having that job. Whereas Alan Bergman, yes, he runs the movie studio, but he sort of came in as more of a lawyer and business guy. And Jimmy Pitaro has experience in tech and has experience in sports, but doesn't really have experience in the meat of what Disney does. Now, there are reasons, as I've written, to question all these people, but that's where it stands right now.
Well, that's the thing, is they all have pros and cons, and there is no ideal candidate. Iger has famously pushed aside potential replacements because, in his mind, they weren't good enough. They weren't ready for this job. And it's caused problems because now they have this bench of executives that all bring good things to the table. I mean, like you mentioned, like, you know, Dana Walden is running the television and streaming business, which traditionally has been the profit center of the company and is now really challenged. And they're going to have to figure out how to transition from TV over to streaming. And Alan Bergman is basically the guy in charge of all the big franchises because he's got Marvel, he's got Lucasfilm, he's got the animation studios. All of those film franchise units are under him. And then Pitaro is at the forefront of the streaming issue because ESPN has to figure out how to go from an incredibly profitable television channel to some kind of a slightly less but still profitable streaming business. And you know, obviously the parks are the parks, and D'Amaro is kind of a celebrity in the parks world. Everybody knows him. Here's the problem with Iger. The front runner is not a good place to be with Bob Iger. We have seen that over and over again with these executives who are considered the front runner. And like, I saw one of the trades refer to Dana Walden as this being her job to lose. And I was like, oof, if I'm Dana, I hate seeing that because A, it's not true. And B, it just puts this impression out there that she's campaigning.
Right. Well, I want to push back a little bit on this idea that nobody is ready for it. Because even though they all have flaws and haven't done the whole job, that's because nobody can be fully ready for that position. Bob Iger was not fully ready to be the CEO of Disney until Michael Eisner made him his number two, and he had some years of training. And then even then, Michael Eisner didn't want to step aside, right? Nobody wants to leave that seat. But I think we need to get out of the idea that someone needs to have every bit of experience in order to do the top job. If you think that Josh D'Amaro has done a really good job with parks, see what he can do with more. If you think Dana Walden's done a really good job and has these talent relationships, see what she can do with more.
Right, but they haven't done that. That's the whole problem here, is that Eisner at least put Iger in a number two role to give him that experience. None of these people is in that role now. So unless they make a change in the next year or so and say, okay, you or you two are the anointed ones, we're going to give you more power and see how you handle it, they're going to be flying a little bit blind.
I feel like early next year, we could see that.
Where we say, okay, D'Amaro and Walden, you two are going to be the new co-COOs of the company.
Or just one of them. One of them gets named president, COO. They do the thing where they basically anoint the successor. Now, Bob has done that before and changed his mind. But I think that's what they have to try, and pretty soon.
Yeah, you reported that it wouldn't be this year, which I have also heard. Maybe we come back from the holidays and then there's some January 4th announcement or something.
My dad's birthday. Yeah, I would like to see. I think if they want to give that person a lot of time to be ready, they need to move early next year. But Disney's so focused on this proxy battle that they got to get through that.
Well, that's the other thing, is that they have this whole proxy battle going on that's coming to a head in early April, where I think they are going to comfortably survive this effort by Nelson Peltz to put himself and Jay Rizzullo on the board. They've certainly brought out the big guns. George Lucas backed Disney. The Disney family backed Disney. Nelson Peltz has, you know, he couldn't even get people to go on the record for him in a New York Times profile of him when he asked them to do that. So I think he's got some issues there. But one of the things Peltz has been harping on has been the succession issue. He wants them to have a clear path to succession. And I think a lot of this stuff, I don't want to cite your sourcing on your story, but I think the fact that this stuff's coming out now is probably good for Disney in the proxy battle, because at least it's showing some incremental movement. All right. Thank you, Lucas.
Thanks, Matt.
That's Lucas Shaw, head of the Media and Entertainment Group at Bloomberg. I'm Matt Bellany of Puck. Kim will be back next week.
It's been nearly 5 years since Steven Yeun last joined us to talk about his brooding Korean language film, Burning. Since then, he earned an Academy Award nomination for Best Actor in the 2020 drama Minari and starred in Jordan Peele's 2020 UFO thriller, Nope. Yeun is also the voice of superhero Mark Grayson in Invincible, and he voiced Speckle in the animated series Tuca and Birdie. The Netflix limited series Beef reunites him with two other Tuca and Birdie alumni. Yeun's co-star Ali Wong voiced Birdie, and Lee Sung-jin, or Sunny as Yeun calls him, was co-executive producer of the animated series before he created Beef. The Netflix show begins when Yeun's struggling blue-collar Danny clashes with Wong's well-heeled Amy, who's working on a deal that will make her truly rich. Their first encounter is an all-too-relatable road rage incident that spawns an ever-escalating beef. As Danny backs out of a parking space, an SUV speeds through the lot, nearly hitting him.
What is your problem? What?
You were named like one of the Times 100 most influential people. Did you look at that and go, I am?
Totally. The question mark is the key. Around that time was a total whirlwind. A lot of things were shifting, all the while COVID was in the backdrop, and this kind of amazing happenstance of kind of being able to experience the Oscars was happening too. So I still think I'm in process of it, to be quite honest with you. Not necessarily of like the accolade itself, but just like the trip that that film took us all on. Making it was so natural at times. It just felt like one step after the other, like sitting in the pocket of the thing itself. And that was a really nice feeling. And then to like take it all the way to experiencing the Oscars like that, I was just like, wow, this film just keeps going. I think we all need to have a postmortem powwow still with the cast and crew. Yeah.
I mean, these are heavy movies you've done. Like Burn was so intense. And then you do this one. And I would imagine a lighter intensity, maybe a little lighter. Maybe. I hope.
I'd love to do something lighter. I look forward to that day. I will say that these things, to me, in their own ways, are light. They're not light material. You know, they perhaps ask something of you, but there's such a joy in the experience of it for me. I'm largely like so privileged to, I guess, have this job. The lighter stuff for me right now feels something like that would be so fun and I'd be so down for, but I think I still got a lot more processing of things to do. So I'm excited for these things too.
Yeah. We actually had, going back to Minari, Lee Isaac Chung on the show. He had come from a very unlikely place to direct that movie. I think he was about to give up on ever making a movie. He had been trying for so long. How did he connect with you? I don't know, backstory there.
Totally. I mean, I hear that story from time to time of just like, you don't really start to live until it's taken from you or you're kind of at the end of the rope of it. You kind of see it for what it is. And I find myself in those same places too. You know, the way that Isaac and I got together was just so simple. One of my agents that we share, Christina Chow, was so instrumental in putting us together. And she just approached me one day and was just like, hey, I have this script by your cousin. And I was like, who is my cousin? What are you talking about?
I forgot about that.
And yeah, I was like, what are you talking about? And she's like, I don't have a cousin in the business. And she's like, Isaac. And I was like, oh, that's my wife's cousin. And, I had seen his film, Munyang Rangabo, in Chicago the first year my wife and I started dating. And we never spoke about working together. I met him maybe once or twice in my whole life. And then to just get this script out of thin air and then to read it and then see how deep he was as a human and how wonderful he is as an artist, I was just like so blown away. And I was like, let's talk about it. And then next thing you know, we're making the thing. It was so bizarre.
I mean, it doesn't feel like the safest choice, but it's amazing how it turned out to be such a big deal in the end, because I'm sure you went into it thinking it's a little movie that a few people will see, but I want to do it. Or maybe I'm wrong. You tell me.
Well, you know, at the time, I think we were kind of riding in this wave of opening up Hollywood and the stories we tell to other experiences that perhaps we haven't seen.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, parsing through those, a lot of them felt like they were still in this mode of trying to explain their own existence. And that's fine. I think there's this time and place for those things. But for me, I was really just more interested in just like existing. And that was the first script that I read that I could relate to in a cultural way that I was like, wow, this is just about these people existing. So for me, the decision didn't feel too like difficult. I wasn't like, oh, should I or shouldn't I? I was definitely scared. If I had fear, my fear was that I was going to totally ruin this project.
Or,
I was just going to totally like biff it completely. But beyond those fears, what I knew Isaac was trying to say, and then also to have the support of, you know, A24 and Plan B and Christina Oh on our side, it was really, I don't know, I felt like we had like really assembled like a really good team. So I was excited for it.
Quite a pedigree there. So that's, I mean, I'm running through the stuff you did, but you did Nope and you did, well, Tuca and Birdie, which isn't that light? That's not light.
That is light. That is light. That was very fun.
And you worked with Ali Wong and that's how you got to know her? Or did you know mm-hmm. her before?
I reached out to Ali when she first put out her first special. I was still on Walking Dead at the time. And
yeah, you saw Baby Cobra, right? That's,
yeah.
Baby Cobra is crazy. Yeah.
That store Urban Outfitters has made things very confusing for my generation. You homeless or you a hipster? Is that beard for fashion or for warmth?
It was so awesome. And I was just like, wow, who is this? And I reached out to her and we connected, but we didn't really connect. And then even during Tuca and Birdie, you know, we recorded separately. So I didn't really get to like know her much.
So it is very intense, this one, this beef have.
Have you seen it all?
I've seen it all.
Oh, awesome.
and it was a ride, let me tell you. It sort of starts one way and then it goes the other way. And you're like, oh my God.
That's so great.
I know that Lee Sung-jin was co-executive producer of Tuca and Birdie.
Right.
And this was inspired, I think, by his road rage incident.
Right. So him and I connected a couple years prior, and like he brought this up to me, and I was so taken by his story and what he wanted to explore and the depth in which he wanted to explore it that I jumped in and we just talked about it. And we kind of set up Danny a little earlier, not necessarily where we landed with him, but like we're playing with that idea. And there are other iterations, like Stanley Tucci is someone that we thought about. Sorry, Stanley Tucci, I'm a huge fan.
You're a great actor. It's not about that.
Yeah, incredible. But then when Ali was able to jump in, it just kind of really opened up in a way that I didn't even foresee. And that's the genius of Sonny, of Lee Sung-jin, is he's got it, you know? I'm so lucky to have worked with him. And then I'm so lucky to have worked with Ali and for us to kind of be together on this. It's a great squad. I'm really thankful.
Did you do some kind of like chemistry testing with her to see how it would play? Or was it just, you know, we know who she is and we're doing it?
I think it was more that. It was more like, we know Ali and this will be interesting. And then when we got on set and started like really playing with it, I was like, whoa, this is going to be so fun. Every time Ali and I were kind of like doing our scenes that we didn't have too much of in the front half of the show, it was just like, oh, I cannot wait till we get through this. It's going to be, it's just every time we're so excited. So it was such a joy and a privilege to work with Ali. Like she's an incredible human and an incredible actor.
Just the escalating madness was you were looking forward, I guess.
Yeah,
more
yeah,
madness.
Yeah.
I want more.
More madness, truly.
So I read that at one point she thought that you sensed that she was intimidated by you. She said, I'm guessing that Stephen could probably sense that I was a little intimidated and nervous about co-leading with him because at this point, sorry, Stephen, I'm going to read the rest of that sentence. He's like an icon.
Aye.
Before filming, he looked me in the eye and said, I don't know anything you don't know. So were you sensing that? Did you experience that the same way?
I don't know if I was explicitly sensing that. I think Ali's a pretty confident person. I think she's also realistic and so gracious, and she's also honest. And so, you know, she approached me with a respect that I so deeply appreciate and I only reciprocate back to her. And so for her, you know, I could see that she wasn't nervous, but, you know, she was entering into a new expression of herself that perhaps people haven't seen that she was capable of. For me, just talking to her, I wasn't even trying to like calm her down. I just was just like straight up saying like, I really don't know anything you don't know. Like, I don't know. I'm just as worried as you are. For us, that was a really cool bonding moment of just maybe laying down any guard that might have been assumed to be up. And it was just like, you know, we're down for each other.
I hope this isn't a horribly reductionist or awful question, but maybe it's a reasonable question. I was watching Beef and I thought, this is like, there's like a sort of connection to Minari, but dealing with this immigrant struggle, you know, and the pressure to achieve.
Yeah, I don't know if that's reductive at all. We could silo it to those specific experiences, but the thing that I hear and the thing that I'm coming to, you know, personally growing up for me, you know, the narrative that I would tell myself is just like, oh, it's because I'm Korean American, it's because I'm an immigrant that I'm this way. And then you look on like Instagram and you see like other psychologists who are examining the same struggles and traumas that I feel like I'm going through as an immigrant. And like, I'm like, oh, cool, this person probably is an immigrant or an Asian person. And it turns out to be like a white person. And you're like, oh, okay. Like, this is a universal struggle. Like, this is just the struggle of being maybe under like hard capitalism. I don't know what the answer is or what it is, but like we're all kind of in it and we're all made by this place. And so the thing that's been really cool is to like explore this in depth in our specificity and then kind of realize that this is applicable to everyone and people are all experiencing something like this.
Coming up after the break, Stephen Yeun talks about being cast in Marvel's upcoming Thunderbolts, though he dropped out due to scheduling conflicts earlier this year. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes. Join Jacqueline Coley as she hosts a brand new podcast, Scene on Screen. Meet the innovative people at NBC Universal as they share their journeys, inspirations, and the movies that define them. Each episode is an intimate and fun conversation about the impact of film. Scene on Screen is available now, wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. Steven Yeun says he doesn't like to repeat himself. After a breakout role as Walking Dead favorite Glenn, Yeun has branched out into a wide range of films, including the Oscar-nominated drama Minari and Jordan Peele's 2022 science fiction thriller Nope. The Emmy-winning limited series Beef adds yet another color to Yeun's palette. The darkly comedic story centers on a road rage incident that turns into a bitter and wildly escalating feud. Yeun plays struggling blue-collar worker Danny, while Ali Wong plays a well-to-do entrepreneur who's on the verge of striking it really rich. In one scene, the two foes meet to try to settle their beef.
You started this.
Me?
Yeah.
Okay, you're the one who backed into me like a psycho.
You're the one that flipped me off all roided out and
Are you guys leaving, or are you just gonna sit there?
Yo, I'll leave when I wanna leave,
and we'll keep sitting here, you shriveled
Yeah, you.
What the you say? What the you say?
Say it again! I dare you to say it again! Come here!
Psychos.
You're a psycho.
I'm not gonna do any kind of spoilers, because you gotta go on the ride. But there is a scene where you do have to cry. And it takes place in a church, which is all I will say. And I read this whole thing about, I mean, you have to really cry. Like, you have to sob in that scene. I mean, you did go to church as a child. And you found that you needed the singing. I mean, just when they didn't sing, it wasn't so easy. But when they did sing, you were right there.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you're under the gun of whatever it is that, like, makes us feel like we need to be hypervigilant about ourselves or fearful or extra protective over our own selves, the way in which you define your story, the way in which you hold on to like how you're being oppressed, which is so natural, you know, this whole place feels like it's crushing down on you. I think that's a relatable idea. It's such a warm blanket when you're made to forget that you're also connected to everybody and that you don't have to exist alone in a vacuum of being pushed down, but rather there's places you can go or people you can connect to, or just even the natural world you can like connect to understand that you're just part of the whole thing. That was a feeling that I think I was exploring. For me personally, when I go to church myself, I don't really go regularly to church anymore, but when I would go, I would find myself very emotional. And I always wondered why. And I feel like it might be because that's the time when I can lay down myself. I don't have to hold that so hard and like so tightly, and I can just let that go. And then I can just kind of be part of the whole thing, especially when people are singing together. When they stopped singing, I could not go there. And then as soon as they started singing, I was like gone. And so that scene is brought to you by everybody there.
That's a beautiful idea. At one point, there's a sort of a psychedelic experience. I know you said you have some limited experience with that in real life.
Sure. I've dabbled in the psychedelic.
Was that enough for you to feel like I can play this because I've had enough experience with it to play it?
Perhaps. I would say even Danny is unaware of the experience that he's going on too. So I kind of just like let go to the whole thing. Like, what does it mean to be poisoned? You know, that's ostensibly what has happened in that moment is those two have been poisoned by poison berries. And now they're drunk off that poison. And maybe they can see themselves a little bit clearer or from a different angle that could be illuminating for them. I don't know.
Yeah. There was a little bit of that everything everywhere kind of vibe to me. Sure. Like, where are we going?
Totally.
Where is this going? It's getting crazy.
Exactly.
You and Ali both broke out in hives when you finished filming?
Yeah. I mean, we checked in together. Now that I'm thinking about us both working out in hives, I wonder if it was just us being in the woods that did that to us.
Oh, okay, that might be it.
Yeah, you know what I mean? But I did feel this real come down of having to hold all that tension for so long, you know?
Yeah. Danny is a stressed out character and feels like a very different, even physicality for you.
Oh man, my back and my shoulders and my neck were just like up to my ears the whole time. But I relate to that experience too, you know, like that's not part of me. When I wasn't living in a situation where I could be so privileged to do this work and be aware, I was certainly driven by that and still can be. So I know that tight neck, shoulder, up to your ears feeling pretty well.
Yeah. So this is an A24 series. Netflix has distribution, but there was there a bidding war for it?
I mean, I guess you could call it that. I think we had a lot of suitors, which was really cool. People were really excited for this story. And I think the thing that you could say was very clear was it really started from Sonny. He created this pitch document that was just like unbeatable. I knew what the story was and I was like, I'll buy it. I was like, I don't have money, but I'll make it. But it was just cool to be part of it, the pitch. Like Sonny had really roadmapped this story from beginning to end in such a complete way. And he also opened the door for collaboration. So like when Ali and I got to jump into the pitch with him, it was such a tailor-made experience that I think we didn't have too much trouble going around town pitching this idea.
How did you evaluate this? I mean, I assume you got to vote or no? It was all Sonny.
It kind of became a committee thing. You know, people kind of made choices and it seemed to me that we were all, and also Netflix had made such an incredible offer to us that it felt like the right place. They were just kind of gung-ho from the very beginning and they just like put it on the table and was like, we want to do this. And, you know, you really gravitate towards people that are gung-ho. It felt safe in that way. And the process with them has been really wonderful. The amount of space that they give, the amount of support that they've given us, I'm very thankful. So yeah, we're here and we're able to put it out on such a large platform. And I'm excited for people to be able to access Beef.
So you're zigging and you're zagging, and now you're going to do Marvel's Thunderbolts.
Mm.
You don't like to repeat yourself, I read, and it's obvious.
Yeah, I was so lucky that the people that are making Thunderbolts, beyond just Marvel, who's been really wonderful, Kevin Feige has been really wonderful, but Jake Schreier, who directed many episodes of Beef and is an incredible director, is directing Thunderbolts. And he wanted to see me for a specific role. And he also kind of recruited a lot of Beef family people. Grace Yoon, our production designer, who's also incredible. Harry Yoon, our editor, who is also incredible. And a final piece is he had Sonny write a draft of the script. And so for me, it was kind of a chance to work with everybody again. And that was really exciting to me. And the character that he wanted me to explore was just someone that I could understand, was interesting. And it felt like the next natural zig or zag to be, you know, just lucky enough to keep doing this. I kind of feel amazed by it. I'll be honest with you. Like, I'm still kind of like not knowing how to like fully hold it in my hand. I'm so thankful about it. Yet I'm trying to like live up to it and sit in it and just like let it be without making it too much of a thing. But I'm just trying to do a good job and hopefully I keep getting to do this.
I'm betting on yes. You do get to keep doing
I appreciate it, Kim. Thanks. Thank you.
Steven Yeun, executive produced and stars in Beef. The limited series is streaming on Netflix. Steven, thank you for joining us again.
Thank you for having me. Always good to talk to you.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's show with help this week from PJ Shahamet, John Meek, and Nick Lamponi, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW shows on kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.